Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Today is Wednesday.
Early.
June 20th. We're early this week. It is, for most of Bedford, I don't know if the high school kids are done yet, last day of the school year. So a little bit like Alice Cooper. And as a result, it's going to be interesting this summer where we really don't have a whole lot of guests related to the high school because they are enjoying much-deserved time off. Corey Parker hopefully will enjoy some, at least not time off because he never takes time off, but some much-deserved downtime.
Yeah, maybe a little different schedule.
Yeah. So actually, it occurs to me, too, we need to introduce ourselves. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
All right. Now we're good. We're all set.
I was curious to see how long that was going to go.
Your answer was about 45 seconds. So big news came in. I saw pictures come in on my phone, and I woke up this morning because I passed out last night after roughly 20,000 steps from throwing a lot of batting practice and you name it. But got a text this morning from Kevin Levine with some sweet pictures of Grant inking a deal with the Rockies.
Yeah, really exciting news. Just a monumental transaction for New Hampshire baseball.
It's a monumental transaction for the Colorado Rockies fans are excited. You've seen that on Twitter so far. I think when I checked Grant's post about signing with the Rockies, I think it already had 815 Twitter hearts. I don't know that I would call them. They're likes, but Facebook has likes. Likes or thumbs up. But he had a whole bunch of them where people were excited about the fact that he had signed, the attitude that he had as far as what he's going to bring to the ballpark every day. No surprise to anybody. He's an extremely hard worker. And as his prize for that, he now gets to report to the Grand Junction Rockies, who play at Saplizio Field in Grand Junction, Colorado. And the Rockies are 5-1 or 4-1 after five games. They are a relatively new addition. They, oddly enough, this is like the 6 degrees of Lauren Fox with baseball. They are owned, the Grand Junction Rockies are, by a guy that I used to work for out in California. And they used to be the Helena Brewers before they moved down from Montana to Colorado, which is a logical fit for the Rockies to have their Pioneer League affiliate that close to Denver. Give the kids a chance to come in, get used to a little bit of altitude, and allow the fans the opportunity to see some of the guys who are going to be the Rockies a few years from now, the opportunity to see them when they're young.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense to have the team close by and similar atmospheric conditions for Grant to be hitting in.
I would say it'll be interesting to watch that. You brought up the transition to Wood, which, of course, he's hit with Wood before. At this point, nobody would draft anybody if they haven't hit with Wood. Oddly enough, have you seen, there's a movie with Clint Eastwood in it called Trouble with the Curve?
Yes.
Rotten Tomato, or did you appreciate it?
I think I appreciated it. I mean, any baseball movie, there's going to be a lot for me to appreciate. It's not challenging to find something to appreciate.
Okay, fair enough. I had many challenges with the movie. So if you're a baseball fan, not a baseball movie to watch, at least from my camp. But then again, I was late to the party.
Well, it's not top five.
No, God,
I'm
no.
Saying when I complete the movie, is there something that I enjoyed in the movie or it makes me think about some part of baseball and I can appreciate it? Of course.
So there you go. So regardless, getting back to Grant Levine, Grant's going, we digress and then we come right back. Grant's going to Grand Junction, Colorado. I was curious and I tweeted this morning, I would not mind sporting some Grand Junction Rockies gear if such was to be made available for purchase online. However, the only thing available on the Grand Junction Rockies website is a hat.
That's it?
That's it. A hat for $30.
I saw the tweet from L.O. Fox.
Yeah, I want to get...
Double X, of course.
I want to get my own Grand Junction Rockies shirt made. Is that bad?
Well, I mean, maybe they're going to give you a call and ask for your ideas. I mean, you have a great background in minor league baseball and all things marketing. to you,
going
it's just
too far, dude.
Well, I mean, that's right up your alley, and that's discouraging that's all they have to offer.
I know. I think they could do some serious work selling some things up here in New Hampshire. I think people would be surprised at the number of people walking around in Bedford wearing Grand Junction Rockies garb. So
there you have it. You're the Northeast Regional Sales Manager.
Sales rep. You can make tens of dollars doing that. So Grant's on his way to Grand Junction. We'll report this morning, as in Wednesday the 20th. We will no doubt be watching that. The Pioneer League, for those who don't know how affiliated baseball work, it is rookie level. So we'll walk you through that. Rookie, short season A. So if anybody's ever been to like a Lowell Spinners game, that would be a short A team. That's typically reserved because it starts a little bit later in the season. Short A is reserved for college drafted players, more often than not, who are a little bit older. Then the natural progression is short A to low A, which is the South Atlantic League. In the case of the Rockies, it's I've said it before, favorite stadium, favorite name, the Asheville Tourists down in North Carolina.
Why is it your favorite stadium?
Did we talk about this?
You've mentioned the stadium, but I don't think we know why it's your favorite.
Crash Davis's last home run in Bull Durham is hit there, which I always thought was really cool. But went there in 2003 when I was broadcasting. And, you know, sometimes you go somewhere and it just feels how it's supposed to feel.
Yeah, it's genuine.
It felt exactly like everything that you had ever read or seen or picked up about minor league baseball. Everything was a little bit off, and I walked in there. I was like, okay, this is how this is intended to feel. It wasn't trying to be anything pretentious. It didn't have anything crazy on the menu. They had some between inning contests, but they were kind of hokey. Like, it felt like minor league baseball because it's an older stadium. It's not and no disrespect to anybody with the newer, nicer stadiums, because I love them too, but it didn't feel like a big business. It felt like, hey, this is a stadium. We have a team. People come and cheer it on. We'll play some good music, have some good food. The other thing that I always found neat, which you move from Southern California and it seems like this doesn't exist, and then you move up here and everywhere is like it. It was basically cut out of a forest. So they have, for whatever reason, right field is triple-decked signs. So I don't know why you just wouldn't have cut further into the forest and made a more symmetrical field, but it's like a Green Monster type feature out in right field, and then cuts over, and you think about how many baseballs and by whom have been hit into the forest over the years.
Right.
It's like rings on a tree. So Asheville is the low A for the Rockies. They have their high A, which is Lancaster out in California, which couldn't be more different than Asheville, North Carolina, as far as climate, as far as the landscape of the place. Double A's Hartford, the Yard Goats. Our good friend Tim Restall from used to work at the Fisher Cats. Restall's down there with beautiful Dunkin' Donuts Park. And then Triple A, which is the Albuquerque Isotopes. Then you get to the big club. All of this premature, though, because it's going to be a little bit of time, and Grant's got time. He's got time to develop, get used to things. And you think about the adjustments going from, okay, now I'm moving two time zones over and they're popping me in. There will be some adjustments, but the Pioneer League is a good place. It's a good crucible to kind of test this stuff out.
Yeah, lifestyle-wise, I think it'll be great. He seems like a real down-to-earth young man, and I'm a huge fan of the Midwest and Colorado. So I think that'll be pretty easy for him. In terms of switching to wood, I think he'll have a much better transition or easier transition than most. That's because the challenging thing about going from aluminum to wood is when you hit the ball off the end of the bat or you hit the ball off the handle, you usually don't get a hit. You often break your bat with wood and your flaws are exposed. But he does such a great job of putting the barrel on the ball that, you know, I think he'll have a smoother transition than most.
And that may be the case. I would think that, yes, he puts great wood on the ball and he's a strong kid. And so those attributes will help him out. And not to mention, you consider where he's got gap-to-gap power. He is not a dead pull guy he's a guy who's going to do a little bit of damage, get himself on base, singles into doubles, that sort of thing. So I'm curious. It's fun. We have a team to root for, you know, a different team to root for an entirely different reason. And then we can also critique their play-by-play announcer, too.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's easy to forget the way he sprays the ball, but he's not a dead ball hitter. He hit more balls to center and to left than he did to right in the games we saw this year, and that's going to help him a lot. I mean, he just, if you combine the fact that he already uses the whole field and his plate discipline, he's got such a great makeup to begin his professional career.
And in case you're wondering, the Grand Junction Rockies website, it's at gjrockies.com. And there is a place that you can listen live. So should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that. And then, so that's the young end of things. And we'll move right directly to the old.
the really old.
When I say old, I'm talking older than me and you. He's still kicking around. We were kind of mocking the fact that that he was thinking about taking this endeavor on. And by he, we are talking about Rafael Palmeiro. He of 3,000 hits, 500 home runs, notable feuds with Will the Thrill Clark at Mississippi State back in the day. But looking at Rafael Palmeiro, he is shooting for what might be called one of the biggest redemption stories in sports history. He's 53 years old and he wants to play in the major leagues.
Yeah, that's right. So he's in the independent leagues, and you and I both have experienced that.
Absolutely.
There, which we'll get into. But it's funny right off the top that you mentioned Will Clark, because when you think of Will Clark, you think of, for you and I, sweet swinging lefty when we were kids.
Oh, God. Right? Yeah, well, I'm older than you. So I remember him playing in the Olympics at Dodger Stadium in 1984.
All right, so I was five. Okay. So that was on the early end. But I was actually listening to an NBA radio piece yesterday, and for some reason, they started talking about Will Clark. And what they were saying was, this is the prototypical lefty. And when he was talking about Will Clark, I'm thinking about just this. You know, he was back in the 80s into the 90s, prototypical lefty, and now he's just completely out of your mind as a player. He's just, yes. He's an ancient lefty with a sweet swing.
Yes.
But his contemporary, Rafael Palmeiro, is back at it. So he's 53, signed with the Cleburne Railroaders of the American Association. His son is on the team as a 28-year-old, Patrick. The manager of the team is 33, Shelby Ford. So Palmeiro is 20 years older than the manager, and he's hitting .259 with two homers and seven RBIs. Interestingly, his son is out hitting him. His son is batting .264. He had a home run he had two hits last night, so he went ahead of his dad with the .264 average, four homers and 18 RBIs. So he's probably viewed as more of a prospect right now. And you almost wonder, Cleburne, they obviously wanted the elder Palmeiro for marketing. But
right.
in the package deal with the father-son, they got a decent prospect in the son.
It's tough, and it's hard to describe. No disrespect to anybody who's playing at a professional level, because it's not easy to play at any professional level. Period. There are a lot of talented players that never get paid to play. So no disrespect to anybody when I say this. However, a 28-year-old guy in indie ball isn't going to get a whole lot of looks if he's hitting .259. If he's hitting .459, there's another thing entirely. And you look at like the Evan Gattises of the world, who kind of seemingly come out of nowhere and all of a sudden get it together. 28 people are looking at and going, yeah, it's a little bit old. His son was drafted at one point, was drafted by the White Sox back in the day, played in the Pioneer League, hit .219, never got above .260. He spent 3 years and never got outside of low A ball. And then he's played in the Independent Atlantic League and now in the American Association for a few years. For Rafael Palmeiro, the kind of interesting thing is they live about an hour from Cleburne. So it was not terribly difficult for him to drive there, drive back. I mean, you look at guys playing in the major leagues for the Dodgers or the Angels. Like, there are a lot of guys who drive farther than that time-wise, living in Cota de Casa or any of those palatial enclaves in Southern California that have sprung up. There are guys who drive that far to play in the major leagues, and nobody gives it a second thought. The weird thing, when you look at the Palmeiros, they're not taking the bus either. So they described it in the article that you sent over, like, oh yeah, hey, they're going to Wichita and Winnipeg. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, Kansas City to Winnipeg was 14 hours, and it wasn't an easy 14 hours. I don't think they're driving a car from Texas to Winnipeg, particularly when you consider what the elder Palmeiro made in his career.
Right. And I've been wondering, I haven't had a chance to go through all the game logs to figure out which games Rafael has played. I did notice that he has played in fewer games than his son and has a few fewer at-bats. So I'm guessing he hasn't gone to all of the road games that his son has gone to.
Right.
But this is something I had a lot of fun with, looking at the composition of the league and talk about geography, and with independent leagues, you know, it's an ever-changing landscape where leagues will add teams, lose teams from year to year, and then oftentimes different independent leagues will merge. And all of a sudden, what's happening now with the American Association is it's sort of a combination of some of our recent or our past locations and leagues.
I wonder, as I'm thinking about it, and I don't know, Miles Wolf. Do you know that name?
Yeah.
Okay, Miles was the guy who back in 1986 or 87 bought the Durham Bulls for nothing. And basically that was that, coupled with Bull Durham coming out, coupled with some changes in minor league baseball, all of a sudden this became like a real industry. And Miles might be an interesting guest to get on the show. He's like an encyclopedia of minor league baseball. He's a fascinating dude. But, you know, thinking about the American Association and the Northern League. So I remember back in 2005, I was working in Kansas City. We had some nice close rivals. Like, we could get to Lincoln in 3 hours. We could get to Sioux City in 3.5 hours. We could get to the other two teams that left. Sioux Falls was maybe 5 hours away. St. Paul was 6-ish. So you're not talking, okay, you finish a game in Lincoln, even if it's a 5 o'clock Sunday game, you're in bed by 12:30 or 1, most likely.
Right.
And you get a decent amount of sleep before your phone starts ringing, even if the team's in town on Monday. Decent amount of sleep, go to the ballpark, do what you got to do. All right, ready to go. Let's get it on. I remember 4th of July weekend, we happened to have an early game in Sioux City because they had a concert and fireworks. We were done there by like 1. I was home by 5 o'clock, and I'm like, this is the greatest thing. Like, I get to barbecue with my neighbors. Like, I never get to do this. And when 2005, I was in an airport flying back to California, and I remember getting a text from Rick Muntean.
Right.
Saying, hey, Lo, call me.
Rick Muntean, who no longer has Grant Levine on the roster.
No, yes. Rick Muntean.
6 degrees of Fox.
The Nashua Silver Knights. And by the way, Grand Junction not owned by the Elmores. I just want to get that straight. The Helena Brewers still exist. Bad information. Rick texts me and says, hey, talk to me about this Northern League thing because we're losing 4 teams out of the league. I'm not even going to call it a power struggle. It was just the Gold Clan Group, which is owned by Mike Vec. And has loose ties to, or owns St. Paul, but also loose ties with Sioux Falls, and the other two just went. All of a sudden, I went from these 4 that were reasonably close to the closest one was about 8 hours. In that last season of Northern League ball, where you have Kansas City, 3 Chicagoland teams, Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, and there's one that I'm forgetting that's somewhere, but nothing was close. The amount of time that we spent on buses, and I got really good at crossword puzzles.
Yeah.
So that.
Yeah. You have those, you have that downtime, and the geography of the American Association now is striking because you've got those former Northern League teams in Canada, and the league stretches all the way down to Texas.
Yeah.
With 2 teams down there. And what I'm thinking about is just imagine if our timing was a little bit better. You and I could have been in this league with Rafael Palmeiro.
Yes.
Because the last team I played on was the Sioux Falls Canaries. They're in the North Division of this American Association.
Right.
And you mentioned your time with the Kansas City T-Bones. They're in the South Division of this American Association. So that would have been a lot of fun if we could have pulled that together.
Those leagues get to be interesting. And the playoff structure and the regular season structure, it's a lot of fun. The other thing that it affords is and there are some great books about it, and I can't remember the name of it. I'll try to look it up while I'm talking. But the reason these leagues were founded back in the 90s was so that, first of all, fans had a distaste for Major League Baseball. And the distaste stemmed from canceling the World Series in 1994, which the second you say, God, that sounds like something that's so foreign, it would never happen, I'm sure it'll happen again. The constant struggle for dollars and cents, but would baseball survive something like that? It came from that and from the need to give these guys who are good baseball players, but just for whatever reason weren't in somebody's organization, give these guys a reason to play. And they've turned into good baseball. And there have been a number of, Brad Ziegler is one who I think of, who's a reliever still playing in the major leagues, who was with Schaumburg when I was working in the Northern League. There are a good number of these guys who, for whatever reason, they get overlooked. They change something. They mature. They were in trouble. Now they're not in trouble. They figure out a way to make themselves appealing to the major leagues. And all of a sudden, you have guys who've put together decent careers. So I'm not saying that Patrick Palmeiro couldn't. Just saying that at 28 years old, when you're that far above the league average age, it's tough to get a good look.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is that there's two different kinds of demand for these teams. You know, they are an alternative, obviously, to Major League Baseball, but a lot of these independent league teams are in smaller towns or cities that don't have an affiliated minor league team, but you've got baseball fans all over the country that want to have that local professional baseball experience. You know, one of the teams I played on was in San Angelo, Texas, which a lot of people don't even know about that city, but it has almost 100,000 people who live there. Its claim to fame is that it's the smallest city in the United States that's not on an interstate.
Huh.
So it's kind of hard to get to out in West Central Texas, but with 100,000 people there, you got plenty of baseball fans who want to go see a game without having to get on a bus for 6 hours like you would in a typical independent league. The other demand is from the major league teams for what you're talking about, these peripheral players, prospects who aren't in the affiliated system, but there are, you know, every season you might have one player on each independent league team who gets signed.
Yep.
Or who is a former Double A, Triple A, or even Major League player who's trying to rehab from injury. And so you need somewhere to play. And there aren't that many prospects that come out of the independent league teams, but there's usually at least one per team per season.
And it's fun and it's fascinating to watch. Like we had I've discussed this briefly before. We had David Segui. Segui was a Kansas City, Kansas guy. He played all of our home games. And predictably mashed in that league because he was a major leaguer who had recently shut it down with the Orioles the year before and hit 339. Well, he came back the next year with us and hit 339 in 31 games. And he played all of our home games and some road games. And lest you think that the rosters are stacked so that you could get every major league veteran you could ever want, it's not stacked like that. They do have salary caps, and you're only allowed a certain number of veterans on a team. So there are ways that they make it so that the rosters are as even as they can possibly be, but it tends to work like our fantasy football leagues do. First of all, you can't screw up on your marquee pick. Like, your veterans absolutely have to produce.
Right.
And second of all, you got to get your late round guys who contribute. And in fantasy football, okay, you get a Marcus Colston, you're good. You won your league that year. The the, I guess, corollary, this is the rookies, the guys who are getting the smaller contracts. You better get a handful of rookies that are really contributing to your team and aren't just getting, as John McDonald, who was one of our pitchers for the T-Bones, used to call some of these guys payroll bandits. You better hope that your rookies aren't just being payroll bandits. So the so Segui was one. You always had guys get picked up. We had a kid named Byron Embry, who's not a kid anymore. Byron is a pitching instructor now out in Colorado Springs, but Byron was throwing in the mid-90s, and because we were in Kansas City, he pitched in the Northern League All-Star Game in 2006, and there were a dozen radar guns down below all clocking Byron because the Royals were had a game as well, and scouts were there, and somebody wanted to see him, and he wound up getting up to AAA with the Royals. Before I forget, the name of the book about the Northern League is called Wild and Outside: How a Renegade Minor League Revived the Spirit of Baseball in America's Heartland. It is by an author named Stefan Fatsis.
Yeah.
You know who that is?
I do.
Okay.
He's the one who wrote, speaking of crossword puzzles.
He wrote Word Freak.
On Scrabble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, you read that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a bitchin' book. Like, so this guy, it's like, if anybody's heard of George Plimpton, who wrote for Sports Illustrated back in the day and Time, and basically invented what I would call participatory journalism. Like, hey, he wrote a book called Paper Lion, where he went and was in training camp with the Detroit Lions, and I'm going to go play quarterback for them and see how this goes. And that was kind of his stock and trade. Well, Stefan Fatsis did the same thing with the NFL, where he went to training camp with the Broncos and was a kicker. He did it with Scrabble, where he went to parks in New York City where people play Scrabble. And it's a fascinating read where he's basically jamming his brain full of every two-letter word, every situation that could possibly exist, every word that has a Q in it, an X in it.
Oh, yeah. You got to have all the two- and three-letter words memorized. And he even went to the national competitions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, he wasn't just a
bootlegger when it comes to that. No.
He could compete.
Yeah.
He was at the highest level.
He wrote that book back in the 90s. Came back and wrote Word Freak later, but Word Freak is a very good read. The Northern League book is also interesting. I found it interesting just because I knew a lot of the people, or you'd hear a reference to somebody and I'd say, they're not naming that guy, but I know who that is. So it's an interesting look. And minor league ball, whether you look in single A, double A, triple A, you name it, all these guys have stories. Everybody has a story about if they didn't make it, why didn't they make it? What befell them along the way? And if they got to the major leagues, what happened that allowed them to get there? And that's really the fascinating thing. Like, not all of us, you know, you talk to somebody who's a software engineer, no disrespect to them, they might not have a story. These guys have, it's like peeling an onion sometimes to figure out, okay, you can legit play, but you've been in indie ball for 12 years. What happened?
Right. Yeah, with all the different locations and, you know, did he get drafted and then injuries, every minor league player has quite a story. And before we wrap up the baseball segment, we gotta mention the interesting story of Juan Soto.
I don't know how that works. So anyway,
because
made a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Yeah, so I mean, thinking about Grant as a first-round pick and thinking about Juan Soto, who is a young slugger for the Nationals.
He's got one of, I don't know who came up with it, but I'm a fan. His nickname is Childish Bambino.
Hey, if you can get it, take it.
It fits into everything.
Is he still 19?
He's 19.
Yeah, so
He will not be, where are we, June, July, August, September. He will not be 20 until deep in the World Series. Can you imagine?
He's already hitting home runs. You know, that's the thing is,
he's hitting .326.
He hit a home run at such a young age that he's, you know, breaking records with his youth. But then this crazy thing happened this week where there was a game that had been delayed from mid-May between the Nationals and the Yankees. And he wasn't playing in that game because he hadn't had his first major league hit yet. He got his first major league hit a few days after that game. So yep. Now in mid-June, he enters into this game that is resumed and hits a home run.
So weird.
And for some reason, Major League Baseball counts that as being hit back on May 15th.
Yeah, it's funny because you look at Baseball Reference and you look at the game logs and it lists him with a, let's see, Juan Soto debut, oddly enough, May 20th, 2018.
So he debuted on May 20th.
Yes. 2018 batting game log, date, May 15th.
Huh. Hit a home
start
run.
Start date, May 15th.
Hit a home run on May 15th, but his major league debut was on May 20th.
Right. And again, I'm going to say I'm not a software engineer, occasionally web developer guy messing around with that sort of stuff and spec'd out a lot of projects like that. So I'm looking at Baseball Reference and going, I wonder what kind of gymnastics had to take place on the back end of this website for his debut to occur after a game that was on his game log.
Well, that's just a perfect word for it. This is nothing but gymnastics. Why would it be so difficult to say that the at-bats that took place on May 15th happened on May 15th, and the at-bats that took place on June 18th happened on June 18th?
Right.
You know, it's another sentence explanation for that game. The game was delayed and resumed in mid-June, so some of the at-bats happened in May, some happened in June.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think his home run should have happened in June. That's when it should count.
I find it interesting. It makes me happy. Kid's hitting 326. And the more guys like this that come out of the minors and people are talking about and they captivate a town, the better it is for the game. The more guys like that that have kind of transcendent performances right out of the gate, the better off it is, whether it's Aaron Judge, who, if you're a Red Sox fan, I know it's easy to shake your head at the Yankees, but Yankees being good is good for baseball, hands down, no doubt, because there are Yankee fans everywhere. Love them or hate them, it's good for baseball. The Red Sox being good is good for baseball. The Houston Astros being good, it's good for Houston. But it doesn't have that same far-reaching effect. And they used to always say it about the Washington Senators, first in war, first in peace, last in the American League. The Washington Nationals, yeah, they've been to the playoffs, but they haven't been a whole lot better. So now this year with Dave Martinez there, and of course it's nice to get that little shot of adrenaline from Juan Soto in May, air quotes around May. But it's nice to get that.
It's fun for Bryce Harper, considered by many to be the best in the game or one of the top two or three best in the game, to have other guys on the team who are fun to watch and fun to follow, like Juan Soto and then Max Scherzer on the hill. That's just a really fun team to follow. So, but you think about, Bryce Harper, one of the best hitters in the game. You think about the youth of Juan Soto. And it all goes back to Grant, who is got to be considered one of the best, if not the best hitters to ever come out of New Hampshire. And it's just going to be really exciting to see how it goes for him. We wish him all the best.
We certainly wish him all the best. And it's going to be a fun summer of baseball. So we will see how that continues. Do we want to go like Kramer when he was test driving the car on Seinfeld, or do we want to take a break?
We could.
Harry would probably like it better, but
if we went straight through or took a break,
we went straight through. It makes his job way easier.
But doesn't, I mean, the music, I kind of like the music okay. In between.
All right. So with that said, take a break. We'll come back, talk about the U.S. Open, the NBA draft, coaches, the World Cup that I haven't seen one second of.
Well, that's what Twitter's for.
Yeah. True.
Go to Fox Sports on Twitter. Only one X.
So yeah.
You can see some highlights.
Clarify. So we'll take a quick break, come right back. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Back here in our luxurious studios up on Meeting House Road in Bedford, New Hampshire, 03110.
Yes, sir.
Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, the last 25 minutes or so of Fox on Sports. And I feel like the only thing that I've been thinking about and talking about in the last week with all that's going on in the world, all the everything that I'm not going to get into because this is a sports show and I enjoy doing it, is Phil Mickelson, really.
Yes.
Committed what I would consider to be one of the worst, most flagrant derelictions of justice in the history of sports. They should take away all of his majors titles.
Absolutely.
They should take away his Rolexes. They should take away everything that belongs to Phil Mickelson, put in a big bonfire and burn it, and leave him in the middle of the desert so that animals can eat his carcass. That is what should be done, because he chased down that putt and touched it before the ball had stopped rolling.
Keep him out of the Hall of Fame. Wipe
He's
off all
out
the
of
records.
Hall of Fame. You're done.
He's actually done for the
you're
tour.
Done.
Done with the tour for the rest of the season.
You are never allowed to mention the word golf, let alone play golf, purchase golf ball. You can't even purchase tees.
Rest of the year suspension.
Ever. No, never.
Done.
He's done. You're done, Phil. Just from reading some of these articles, like, that was my general feeling. Do I care? No, I really don't.
All right. So
if you hit your ball and you want to chase the ball, dude. I got so many other things to worry about in the world than that.
We're talking about
practice on the
we're
practice
about
range.
Putts.
Like, really?
We're talking about rules.
Oy.
So here's the third round.
I get rules. Like, I understand the rules exist for a reason.
There's lots of rules in golf. Lots of rules that could have come into play here. This was the third round of the U.S. Open on Saturday at Shinnecock. Here's what happened.
And by the way, Hanson is giving you context, but I'm going to say that if you're listening to the show, unless you've been listening, living under a rock, you no doubt heard about this, because the amount of clutching of pearls from all the golf purists when mere minutes before Phil Mickelson had been their boy, he was their bastion of hope, and then to go and do this.
And here he was. Just
a transgression unlike any other.
Just a normal
putt for
bogey.
Why didn't I think
of
that last week? Jim Nantz would have loved that.
Normal putt for bogey, and then this. Phil putts for bogey, missing it on the low side. Shinnecock's 13th. Fast break from the cup to one-legged turnaround. Phil putts rolling ball.
Uh-oh.
Heated lip out gets marked, missed, made, and penalized. 8 becomes a 10. Curtis Strange questions birthday boy about 13. Phil keeps his chin up.
I'm going to read to you from Ian O'Connor on ESPN. Mickelson made a mockery of a sports national championship on his 48th birthday, and he should now do the honorable thing and remove himself from the tournament. He hit his moving ball out of frustration on the 13th green at Shinnecock Hills, and then he told a counterfeit tale about his intent. Like, really, dude?
That was enjoyable. I mean, you had the full posture into that one. You had the great voice.
Yeah.
And we were texting about that article on Sunday. That was either Saturday night or Sunday morning that he posted that, and turns out Phil did not do those things, did not come out and apologize and withdraw from the tournament with his tail between his legs. He explained it after the round on Saturday in that question and answer period with Curtis Strange, who, of course, is a two-time U.S. Open champion and one of those more, you could say, old-school types who is about, you know, the tradition and the etiquette and following the rules. And he didn't really seem to appreciate what Phil had done in those questions outside the clubhouse there at Shinnecock. But what Phil did is he said, hey, I didn't want to keep hitting it back and forth on the 13th green. You know, if you saw the play, the shot, the putt was going to go off the green. Then he was going to have to chip it back up and do his best to two-putt and not putt it off the green again. And he didn't want to deal with it. He's already out of the tournament. So he made the calculation of, I have a better chance at getting a better score if I do this turnaround, hit the putt on the move, and said, you know, hey, whatever the penalty is, I'm willing to take it. I'll take my two-stroke penalty and move on. And that way the fans don't have to watch me keep hitting it back and forth. So he, you know,
it's like air hockey on a golf course.
Right.
I mean, and the other thing that this took away from, which just drives me nuts. Okay. First of all, it does give us a distraction from other things, and which isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world, that everybody's talking about this instead of it's the bread and circuses equivalent in 2018. We're watching this instead of focusing on something else that may be going on. So there's that. The other thing is the condition of the golf course was so bad and it was so unplayable Friday and Saturday that really if you're looking at this and saying this is Phil's fault, what did Zach Johnson say? USGA lost the course. And then it played well on Sunday, obviously, particularly if you're Tommy Fleetwood, it played superb.
Yes,
really.
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, on Saturday, I heard a stat that the last group of players shot a combined 93 over par. I mean, the course was just out of control. Phil shot an 81. Ricky Fowler was in the 80s. And then on Sunday, he shot a 65. It was all to do with the conditions of the course. And what Phil did is it brought up two major issues, the condition of the course and the rules.
Yes.
And a lot of golf enthusiasts have a problem with both of those things. You know, why is it that the USGA and every US Open has to push it to the brink and risk the course getting out of control so that the players, the best players in the world, say it's more than unfair. It's just ridiculous and silly that you're penalized for hitting a good shot. If you hit a shot within 6 to 8 feet of the cup, it should stay on the green.
I go to the same thing that I'll think about with other sports. Like, there's a reason that the NBA doesn't have a layup contest. The NBA has a slam dunk contest. There's a reason that Major League Baseball doesn't have a singles hitting contest. They have a home run derby. People like the exciting plays. And honestly, I really liked it when Tiger was shooting double digits and winning by 8 or 10. And these guys were putting up eye-popping numbers and hitting the screws out of the ball and hitting iron shots from a million yards away. And things were checking up, sliding backwards, or basically people were hitting things that stop on a dime. I want to watch these guys do things that I can't do. I don't want to watch them play and go, boy, I feel like notwithstanding the condition of the course, boy, I could have done that.
Right.
I don't want to watch that. I want to watch these guys dominate. So why are we doing this thing where make the course as hard as we possibly can to bring these guys? No, I want to watch these guys absolutely rake and play really good golf instead of declawing them on these courses.
Yeah, and I don't mind, you know, different tournaments having a different feel, different style, and some being more challenging and more conducive to a winning score.
That's
right?
Not what I'm saying.
No,
I mean,
no, I know.
There's Fenway Park and there's the Polo Grounds.
Right.
And you've got more, but you know, you get the idea.
You got the Masters. They set it up where it's more of a, hey, let's just go out and see who can play the best. And, you know, the Rays Creek is there. You know, you can have, you know, Jordan Spieth, who can get a double bogey or worse and lose the tournament, and you don't have to have a pin that's on the edge of a cliff. You know, and you see
you see
winning scores in the Masters that are often, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15 under. Why does the winning score at the U.S. Open have to be one over? You know, you can have tighter fairways, higher rough, but why does there have to be this mentality of, gosh, if they shoot under par, like that was just way too easy. Yeah. I mean, they ruined the course for the Shinnecock members again. You know, the whole thing was in 2004, what happened where you see videos of them putting water on the greens.
And it just rolls.
And it rolls off. It doesn't sink in.
It's like mercury.
Yeah. And there was that disaster and embarrassment for Shinnecock Hills, and now they come around and do it again.
After swearing that they weren't going to do it again.
Yeah.
That's the best part. Like, oh, yeah, we'd never do that again until we did it. But, yeah, hey, why would we ever expect anything less?
Right. So then the other big topic that comes into play with what happened with Phil are the rules of golf. We've talked about this on previous shows. They are quite strict, and some of them don't make a lot of sense. But this one is interesting how it brought into play different rules. you know, the first rule, the natural that comes out is what he was penalized for. If he hit a moving ball, two-stroke penalty. But it's kind of interesting that there are these other rules about etiquette and, you know, a flagrant breach of etiquette. Could he have been disqualified? Some of the tour pros seem to think that he should have been disqualified. Others don't. Like Brandt Snedeker came out with a quote and just said, hey, he's taking advantage of the rules. And they evaluated it. They decided it wasn't flagrant enough to be disqualified. And I think that's fine. You know, if they want to change the rules and say specifically that, you know, if you chase after a moving ball and hit it on the move, you're disqualified, that's fine.
Make that the rule.
But if not, then, you know, I'm fine with it being a two-stroke penalty. And I'm kind of curious about what would be or what has been, you know, flagrant disregard of the etiquette that has led to a disqualification. I mean, I can picture, let's say Phil had, while Beef Johnson was putting, if Phil had run across the green yelling and screaming during his stroke, you know, to interfere with another player's performance, to me, that would have been flagrant and say, what are you doing, Phil? You know, you're interfering with somebody else's play. It's a flagrant breach of etiquette. You're going to be disqualified.
Right.
So, you know, I'm curious on other instances where that has actually come into play, that rule. I haven't heard of any, but I was fine with just a two-stroke penalty and move on. And if you want to change the rules to be more harsh and more specific, go ahead.
Yeah, it's, you know, people are still going nuts and losing their mind about this sort of stuff. I mean, John Daly did it back in 1999. The USGA made him write a letter. A letter of apology to the host. Yes. Mr. Daly, can you please put down your cigarettes and your Diet Coke and M&M's and write a letter?
The USGA is all about letters.
It's bizarre.
So they're writing letters to your friend about, are you sure you're a
handicap? Yeah.
Are you sure one of our courses didn't make you shoot that 88? Are you sure?
Dear at USGA, I'm sorry I stopped the ball. Sincerely, your friend Phil. You know, it's, I don't know. I feel like everybody kind of just took this way too seriously, which is that's what golf fans do. We talked about it. Did we talk about it last week? The people who sit at home and watch for rules infractions and call the USGA. And
right.
You're like, don't you have anything better to do? Like,
exactly.
Really? It's just kind of one of those things. And it would basically be like if you combine Major League Baseball and The Voice, like, okay, so we're not going to send it to New York City so that somebody can watch it, but we're going to have fans text in, safe or out. Okay, 51.1% of America says that Mike Trout was out. Therefore, Trout is out and the inning is over. Back after this. Like, what? I mean, it's either you are set up so that you have people watching it at the course, and they're watching it at the course and they make a decision then, or you're not watching it. And I'm even fine in this day and age if you have an all-knowing being somewhere who is watching a number of different screens, but there are certain things, make a decision, leave it on the course, be done.
Right.
And I guess the other thing to me that was just weird about everything was Sunday was an entirely different tournament than Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Yeah, they changed the conditions. They watered the greens. They
Magic.
Put more of the pins in the middle of the green so that you weren't risking this pin by the cliff situation where guys are shooting in the 80s and then they turn around and shoot in the 60s. And like you mentioned, what this does is that has distracted us from the brilliance of Tommy Fleetwood, who shot a 63 on Sunday. He had a putt for birdie on 18 to shoot 62, which would have been the all-time low in the U.S. Open.
Tin Cup didn't do that. Oh, yeah, he did on Saturday. we're talking only real U.S. Opens?
This is for the real U.S. Asterisk, real U.S. Open. Record is 63, shot by, among others, well, among, there were two, I think, in the, Johnny Miller shot a 63. So he tied Johnny Miller, and it was so much fun to watch Tommy Fleetwood. I found myself rooting for him a little bit, even though there were five or six Americans at the top of the board. I mean, it's just so fun to watch him play. Just this young guy seems to be carefree, just hitting lasers at every pin or he's rolling in 30-foot putts, sort of like what you're talking about. He was just tearing up that course. And, you know, even with those conditions, you and I would have shot a 120.
Yes.
But he was just lights out and brilliant.
So the other thing that drives me bonkers about it, though, is the later that you played in the day, the less your chances were on Saturday, particularly of scoring well.
Oh, yeah.
Because the course starts to dry out and then forget it. You have no chance. And the same thing held true to a degree on Sunday. So you have Fleetwood coming up, and he almost became, for lack of anything better, he was like a human cut line.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you have to beat this guy who's already in the clubhouse. You have to beat him now. And to me, that's, yeah, he played a great round, and he played, it was go for broke golf. And that, to me, like, that's the thing. I don't want to see these guys play it safe. I want to see these guys gamble and have the opportunity for reward, as opposed to, I don't want to gamble because it's going to be so penal if I miss that, forget it, I'm not going to do it. I want to see these guys gamble and feel the hair on the back of my neck go up when a dude hits a shot, because you hear the crowd just go, oh, like, that's why people watch this sport. People don't watch this sport to watch these guys lay up. I go back to Tin Cup. Tin Cup never laid up on that 18th hole.
That's right. That's right.
Come here. Keep hitting in the water. Keep hitting in the water, man. Just keep going. Hitting 11, or laying 11, hitting
ball,
12.
Ball. Well, the saving
grace. We've talked about that before. I know that. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, great scene.
The saving grace for Sunday at the U.S. Open, along with Fleetwood, was that in that second to last group, you had Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson, who they saw the plus two of Fleetwood in the clubhouse. He was the guy to catch. And they were the two that had the best shot throughout the day of, you know, could they get in the clubhouse ahead of Fleetwood? They were the ones who were kind of vacillating between plus three and even. And it was fascinating to watch those two, because you heard all the stories about how great of friends they are. They work out together. They challenge each other. They push each other. Dustin Johnson's number one in the world. Brooks Koepka won the U.S. Open last year. But then while they're actually playing, they weren't talking to each other. I mean, it was game on.
Right.
And what you were looking for, you got from Brooks Koepka. He went at those pins.
Absolutely.
Right from the first hole. He was dialed in. He was being aggressive, hitting great shots, you know, making more birdies than most. And then down the stretch, just amazing ups and down, up and downs to make par. He really earned it. You know, he had the tap in, but he knew on the 18th that he could make a bogey and still win, and that's what he did. But he just had so many clutch shots coming in, and it was fun that at least he was aggressive and he earned it. It wasn't like he backed into it by just, you know, making 18 pars.
Right. Now, and you had other guys too that kind of snuck in that made it fun. Tony Finau, I enjoy him. Big, tall guy, long swing, but just crushes. And you look at this group of guys and you say, all right, even I wish Tiger had been in the mix on Sunday, because that was really the only thing it was missing. But you have some dudes who appear to have a little bit of personality, which is what that sport needs. By the way, side note, because what, we have 6 minutes or so. 40th birthday today of Dirk Nowitzki.
Oh yeah, Dirk.
Yeah.
What a fine time for it in NBA draft
week.
We
got NBA draft tomorrow.
Yeah. A lot going on. We had a fun talk with Jim Plavik last week about the NBA draft.
And I keep seeing guys from Draft Express on ESPN, now that you mention it. Jonathan Givony.
Yeah, I mean,
Mike Schmitz, they I've seen them both on in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, those are the guys that have worked with Jim for years and years. They have a small team at Draft Express, and they're tight-knit group, and you see those mock drafts on ESPN from Jonathan Givony. And like I said, all those highlight reels that are 8 to 10 minutes long, really well-produced, are Draft Express videos. So,
yeah.
You know, check those out. You know, this will air on Saturday after the draft, but you can go back and look at, you know, all those top guys and get a sense of who they are. And a lot of news heading up to the NBA draft. You know, Mo Bamba, who Jim talked about, telling Memphis basically, you know, I don't want to go there, not sharing the physicals with him, with them. So it's going to be fascinating. Some chatter about what will the Celtics do? Maybe Dante DiVincenzo at 27, who, if they got him then, it seemed like he'd be a steal with the athleticism that he has. You know, it'd be a great fit for Boston coming off the bench. So exciting time in the NBA. Then there's the whole Kawhi Leonard situation.
Right.
So I'm excited about how that's playing out, because he's the first guy who stood up to the Spurs organization and said, I don't really like the Spurs way, the way that it's playing out with me. And I understand why, because, you know, Popovich came out and challenged him while he was out, basically, you know, praising LaMarcus Aldridge about how he's out there every day grinding it out, and obviously throwing a veiled jab at Kawhi. And Kawhi's like, you know, this is just not how I want to be treated. Tony Parker didn't have his back in the media. And now apparently Greg Popovich and Kawhi are meeting in Southern California. Spurs are trying to claw back the possibility of Kawhi staying with the team. But Kawhi's saying, I want out.
Yeah, it's gross. It's gross in so many ways. First of all, if you didn't like the way you were being treated months ago, you're a heavily compensated employee. Walk into Popovich's office and have a conversation with him. And I'm aware that he's a gruff guy, but he's also a human being. And that's the way to do it, instead of hiding behind a quad injury for a few months, handicapping your team, and then getting into summer and trying to force a trade to LA that isn't necessarily going to happen. Like, I feel, and I like Kawhi as a player, and I liked him as an off-court guy until this, and I just don't get it. The only thing I can think of is that somebody somewhere has given him some just really garbage advice.
Well, it's interesting, because you and I usually are on the same page on some of these things, and I just see it from the opposite perspective. I think the Spurs as an organization, they should have his back to the very end, until they're absolutely sure that he's doing something crazy and he's 100% ready to play and he's not. Then, okay, then maybe you start to talk about things. But why isn't it that Popovich goes to him, or R.C. Buford or somebody in the front office goes to him and says, hey, what's going on? And they work it out, instead of Popovich going out in the media and throwing him under the bus.
Yeah, and I guess we don't know. We don't know what machinations had happened. We don't know if anybody had, if Pop had reached out, or if Kawhi had reached out, and either side was rebuffed either way. We just don't know that. So it's hard for us to say one's right, one's wrong. We don't know what went on. All I know is what the optics are, and what I see of optics are, dude, not playing. And, well, he's going to be back this time. He's going to be back now. Well, no, he's not going to be back for the rest of the year. And you wonder, were they being forthright with the Spurs the whole time, or were they trying to, okay, San Antonio is not our end game, therefore, let's find a way to get out of here.
Right. Well, you know, that long form article on ESPN, I think it was Ramona Shelburne. If you go back in history, I think the story was that Kawhi felt like the first time he hurt his quad, the Spurs pushed him back on the court too soon. And so he's thinking, you know, this is why I need a second opinion, because they don't have right. My best interest at heart. They're just trying to get me out on the court when I'm not ready. But the one misstep I think he's made here is by being so outspoken about demanding that I want to be traded to the Lakers, or making it known that I want to be traded to the Lakers. Yes, I get that it's important for the other team, the acquiring team, to know that he wants to re-sign with them. So this information is important. But to me, it's borderline Carmelo Anthony, the mistake he made way back when he was in Denver. He's halfway through the season. He's going to be a free agent. What he should have done is just let himself become a free agent and then go sign with the Knicks. Instead, he demanded a trade mid-season. The Knicks had to gut their roster, and then he goes to New York, and they're never a contender because he demanded the trade before he became a free agent. And so with Kawhi, you know, why are you broadcasting that I really only want to go to the Lakers? All that's going to do is if it gives the Spurs more leverage.
Absolutely, absolutely. Give us everything that you have,
right,
please.
Right. Now the Spurs, that's what the Spurs can do.
Right.
Yeah, okay, we'll take Ball, we'll take Kuzma, we'll take Randall, we'll take at least one more first-round pick. They get whatever they want, you know, based on how they value each of those players. And why not Kawhi just play out one more year and then go to L.A. as a free agent?
Right. I don't know. I wonder about the wisdom of that. So, all right. So we're about to close. And with that said, Dirk Nowitzki, like we said, turning 40 today. A hilarious text exchange with his trainer. I can't find the one that was from his birthday, but it was, "You're 40 as in 40 guys who are blowing by you on your birthday." This one was from May. Nowitzki at the end of the season, "When do we start?" And the trainer says, "I told you 4 years ago that you were done 4 years ago. Your game has been in decline since Havlicek stole the ball from you. Your full court sprints are timed to the calendar."
That's awesome.
Yes. So he's still kicking around, though.
Yeah. I mean, hey, like I heard the clip recently, nobody's figured out how to guard that fadeaway yet.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if he wants to, you know, get it going again this summer, come back for another year, the Mavs are, they're not going to push him anywhere. They want him there. They love him. And, you know, he accepted his role last year where he's playing in spurts almost like Kevin Garnett, you know, 5 or 6 minutes. And, you know, they've had a long-term marriage that's worked really well. And
yeah, and Cuban's not going to kick him to the curb.
No.
They'll have him keep playing.
The more Dirk, the better.
The context that it was shown this morning was a name that people will know tomorrow, Luka Doncic. Hitting a little fadeaway with his foot kicked up, and they put him side by side because obviously,
right,
European guys,
yep, 6'8" and above,
not
the best Doncic, athleticism.
6'6", 218 is what he's listed at.
Okay,
so at least that's for Wikipedia. So, with that said, thank you to our guest. Oh, wait, we didn't have one. thank you to the crew here at Bedford 105.1. Harry, Bill, Colleen, and Chris, and thank you to you for listening. Have a wonderful first week of summer. We will catch you next week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.